Fair. On today's Fresh Air, writer Michael Chabon. He just won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, an homage to the early era of superhero comics. It tells the story of two Jewish cousins, one who has just escaped Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia and needs money to smuggle out his family. The cousins take advantage of the Superman craze and create their own superhero, the Escapist. No lock can hold the Escapist while he frees people from the chains of tyranny and injustice. Michael Chabon is also the author of Wonder Boys, which was adapted into last year's film starring Michael Douglas. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the music of the group Love. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today that his administration is committed to building a missile defense system and should not be held back by the nearly three-decade-old anti-ballistic missile treaty with Russia. The president called for a new framework for the U.S. relationship with Russia and said he wants to meet soon with Russian President Vladimir Putin to convince him that the missile defense system is not a threat to peace. President Bush said he will unilaterally reduce U.S. stockpiles of nuclear weapons, but he didn't say how much of a reduction he had in mind. A smaller tax cut than what President Bush first proposed has emerged in a tentative compromise reached by congressional negotiators today, but the House and Senate are still trying to work out differences in spending to reach a final budget deal. NPR's David Wellner reports from the Capitol.
Mr. Bush was quick to praise the tentative budget and tax cut deal worked out at the Capitol, calling it a great day for the American people and for the American taxpayer. The deal is actually a significant reduction in the $1.62 trillion figure the president had earlier insisted was the right size for a tax cut. Budget negotiators instead came up with a $1.25 trillion 10-year tax cut, and they added another $100 billion in immediate tax relief for this year, raising the total figure to $1.35 trillion. But it's still not clear whether the reduced size of the tax cut will be acceptable to some House Republicans who've insisted the tax cut should, if anything, be larger than what the president proposed. And Senate Republicans say more spending is needed than what House Republicans have approved for the budget. David Wellner, NPR News, the Capitol.
The jury has reached a verdict in the trial of a man accused of killing four girls in the bombing of a black church in Birmingham, Alabama. Thomas Blanton Jr., a former Ku Klux Klansman, was brought to trial in the case after 36 years. NPR's Debbie Elliott has been watching the trial in Birmingham. Debbie, how did the verdict play out?
Well, after deliberating for about 2.5 hours, the jury, made up of 8 whites and 4 blacks, returned its guilty verdict against Thomas Blanton Jr. The former Klansman had been charged in the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church here in Birmingham. A Klan bomb exploded during Sunday morning services, killing 4 black girls who were in the basement ladies' lounge.
Thank you, Debbie. That was Debbie Elliott in Birmingham, Alabama. In stocks today, the stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 163 points, or 1.5%, to close at 10,898. Advancing issues led declines by 3-2. Volume on the New York Stock Exchange was more than 1 billion shares. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 52 points, or 2.5%, to close at 2,168. The S&P 500 gained 17. This is NPR News. Hollywood writers are back at the bargaining table with movie and television producers trying to reach a contract agreement before the current contract expires at midnight. Writers Guild officials have not called for a strike vote, and both sides could choose to extend the negotiations. The disputes include how much the studios should pay writers when their work is rerun or broadcast overseas. Schools in Seattle and 4 other Western Washington state districts are closed today because of teacher walkouts. Public school teachers are marching for higher pay and lower class size. Jason DeRose reports from member station KPLU in Seattle.
More than 70,000 students throughout the state have the day off. Striking teachers are protesting state budget proposals they say don't set aside enough money for raises and classroom operations. Anita Garcia Morales is a middle school teacher in Seattle. She says while the walkout may inconvenience parents, it's important to get the attention of the state legislature.
I'm real comfortable with this issue because I think people really understand that, and we don't have backlash at all from parents. We've had a tremendous support, outpouring of support.
The walkouts don't mean less instruction time for students. The Seattle School Board has added an extra day at the end of the school year to make up for missed class time. For NPR News, I'm Jason DeRose in Seattle.
The Navy has concluded its controversial training exercises on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Navy ships and planes bombed and shelled the firing range on the island for 4 days in a row using non-explosive ammunition. The Puerto Rican government opposes the exercises and has filed suit. It says that the training violates its new anti-noise law. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and the Amundsen Foundation for support of the NPR Endowment, helping to ensure NPR's financial future.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael Chabon, won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction 2 weeks ago for his novel The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Chabon is also the author of Wonder Boys, which was adapted into a film last year starring Michael Douglas as a professor and novelist. Chabon's new novel begins in 1939 during the early days of the superhero comic craze. When the novel opens, Sammy Clay is a young man working for a novelty company. His cousin Joseph Cavalier is a magician and escape artist who has just used some of the tricks of his trade to escape Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia. He's moved in with Sammy and his mother in New York and hopes to make enough money to smuggle his family out of Prague. Sammy suggests that they cash in on the Superman craze and create some superheroes of their own. Several of their characters catch on. The most popular is called the Escapist. He's inspired by Joseph's adventures. Here's Michael Chabon reading the scene in which Sammy and Joseph create the Escapist, a costumed hero whose power is impossible and perpetual escape.
Okay, he said. Listen to this. He started to pace between the drawing tables, looking down at his feet, declaiming in a sharp, barking tenor that Joe recognized from the announcers on American radio. To all those who toil in the bonds of slavery. Bonds? Joe said. Yeah. Sammy's cheeks reddened and he dropped the radio voice. Chains, like. Just listen. It's comics, all right? All right. Sammy resumed his pacing and radio announcer tone and continued to compose his historic series of exclamations. To all those who toil in the bonds of slavery and the shackles of oppression, he offers the hope of liberation and the promise of freedom. His delivery grew more assured now. Armed with superb physical and mental training, a crack team of assistants, and ancient wisdom, he roams the globe, performing amazing feats and coming to the aid of those who languish in tyranny's chains. He is! He paused and threw Joe a helpless, gleeful glance on the point of vanishing completely into his story now. The Escapist. Escapist. Joe tried it out. It sounded magnificent to his unschooled ear. Someone trustworthy and useful and strong. He is an escape artist in a costume who fights crime. He doesn't just fight it, Sam said. He frees the world of it. He frees people, see? He comes in the darkest hour. He watches from the shadows, guided only by the light from... his golden key. That's great! I see, Joe said. The costume would be dark, dark blue, midnight blue, simple, functional, ornamented only with a skeleton key emblem on the chest. Joe went over to one of the drawing tables and climbed onto the stool. He picked up a pencil and a sheet of paper and started to sketch rapidly, closing his inner eyelid and projecting against it, so to speak, the image of a lithe, acrobatic man who had just leaped into his mind, a man in the act of alighting, a gymnast dismounting the rings, his right heel about to meet the ground, his left leg raised and flexed at the knee, his arms thrown high, hands outspread, trying to get at the physics of the way a man moved, the give and take of sinews and muscle groups, to forge, in a way that no comic book artist yet had, an anatomical basis for grace and style. Wow, Sammy said, "Wow, Joe, that's good. That's beautiful."
That's Michael Chabon reading from his book Cavalier and Clay. The most popular superhero that your two main characters create is called the Escapist. What are his powers and how does he use them?
He is initially conceived by Sam Clay and Joe Cavalier to be a superhero without any real superpowers, but to be in a way like Batman, to be the product of intense course of physical training that has brought him to the peak of his abilities as an escape artist. And he performs by day as a vaudeville escape artist, magician, or I guess you could say by evening. And in his spare time with his team of crack assistants, who are his stage hands and his driver and so on in his civilian life, he roams the globe, releasing other people from chains. He uses his skills as an escape artist to liberate political prisoners and concentration camp inmates and orphans from cruel orphanages and so on. But actually, fairly quickly within the story, that isn't enough for Joe and Sammy. That those powers are too limited, and we learn of the existence of this shadowy organization called the League of the Golden Key, and they impart some kind of extra amount of magical superpower to him so that he does eventually become super strong and can do all the great World War II superhero things like tying anti-aircraft guns into pretzel knots and peeling open jet fighter planes and so on.
Now, this superhero, the Escapist, has the ability to do escapes in the way that Houdini did. And Houdini is an inspiration for the characters in your novel, and I suspect something of an inspiration for you as well. Can you talk a little bit about what Houdini means to you? And if you had to learn about picking locks and undoing chains and handcuffs and other stage magic kind of things in order to write this book?
Yes, I did. I never really expected to be writing about Houdini at all. I've always been fascinated by him, but it was only gradually that the theme of escape emerged for me in the writing of this book. But as soon as I recognized it, in that I had this character of Joe Cavalier, who's a refugee from Prague and who has escaped to the United States and freedom, somehow this figure of Houdini began to press itself upon my imagination more and more, and I realized I was going to have to somehow or other work him or his craft or both into the book. You know, the thing about Houdini, the two things about Houdini that interested me, at least from the point of view of this writing this novel, were on the one hand that he did have this legend and that he was in some respect, I think, an unacknowledged forebear of the whole idea of the superhero. In many ways, he was a superhero. He fits the definition in that he had a secret identity. He was really Eric Weiss, the child of a rabbi of Jewish immigrants from Hungary. He was born in Wisconsin, but he let on that he had been born, you know, over there on the other side. And he also fought crime in the sense that, as you probably know, he devoted the latter part of his life to debunking false mediums and people who claim they could communicate with the dead. He had a crusade that was very much like a kind of superhero crusade against these people. So that there was that aspect, but there was also this idea of Houdini as an immigrant, as a kind of hero of immigrants. And it just seemed to me that somebody like Sammy Clay, this kid from Brooklyn, child of immigrants, would probably look up to a guy like Houdini.
Two of the themes of your book are escape and transformation, two themes that are epitomized by the superhero comics, that are themes that also play out in the lives of the main characters, the guys who create the superhero comics. And one character says, Clark Kent in a phone booth and Houdini in a packing crate, they were one and the same thing. You weren't the same person when you came out as when you went in. How conscious of these themes do you think the actual comic book artists and writers were? Do you think that they sat around thinking, we're doing comics that are really about personal transformation?
No, I don't think so. And I don't think Sam Clay realized that back when he was 19 and he was coming up with The Escapist. That is a reflection. What you just read is something that he in his latter years, you know, would
right.
learnedly expound to audiences of comic book fans. There are some people that... there's a great comic book artist, Will Eisner, who created a character called the Spirit and in the 1940s and later went on to, in some ways, invent the whole graphic novel that has become such an important art form in recent years. And, you know, he is a very brilliant man, and one has a sense, reading some of the things he said about how he felt about comic books at the time, that he did have some degree of self-awareness, that he was playing with children's fantasies or adolescent fantasies and expressing them in some way or another.
Another theme in your novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, is the golem, which is something that comes from Jewish legends, and you see certain parallels between the golem and the superhero. Why don't you start by explaining what a golem is?
Well, a golem is an artificial man, essentially, a homunculus, a creature created out of usually clay or mud that then is brought to life by means of incantation and spells. Stories of the golem go all the way back, to the Babylonian exile several thousand years ago. But the most famous golem of all, and the one who appears in my novel, is the Golem of Prague, that is said to have been created by Rabbi Judah ben Bezalel ben Lo in the 16th century. And there are a lot of different stories about that golem. In some stories, he's just created to be an artificial manservant to help sweep up around the synagogue on Friday afternoons, getting ready for Sabbath, you know. And in other stories, there's a more sort of melodramatic tinge to the creation, and the golem is brought to life to be a protector of the ghetto, to be a defender of the oppressed Jews of Prague against pogrom and blood libels. And it's that golem that is the golem in my novel, and that I see as being possibly an antecedent, like Houdini, of the whole superhero idea, and that you have this sort of created man, which is the case with a lot of superheroes historically too, from the Human Torch onward, who is brought to life in order to, you know, protect the helpless and defend the weak. And I kind of had this intuition, I guess, about the golem. And then in conversation with Will Eisner, I asked him why he thought so many of the original comic book creators in the 1930s and 40s were Jews. And he gave me a very logical, sort of economical explanation, but then he said, but I've often wondered if there wasn't something in the Jewish storytelling tradition that didn't lend itself to the creation of Superman. For example, we have this golem story, and that was very exciting for me to kind of get confirmation of something that I had just sort of guessed at, and I wasn't really sure what to do with it until that point.
My guest is Michael Chabon. He won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of weeks ago for his latest novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Chabon, and his latest book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, just won the Pulitzer Prize. Michael, why are you so interested in the formative era of superhero comics?
Well, it was a childhood interest of mine in that I was a big reader of comic books as a kid. And it just so happened that at the time I was most interested, even obsessed with comic books in the early 1970s, was a period when DC Comics, the home of Superman and Batman and The Flash and Wonder Woman, were putting out these big, fat comic books, 64-page, 80-page, and 100-page comic books. And typically, the first story in one of these things would be a new story, but then they would pad the rest of the comic with reprint material. And this material was just stuff they would dig out of their vaults. And it was all this golden age stuff. And, you know, I was little. I was 7, 8, 9 years old. I knew it was not exactly the same stuff as the newer material. You could see there were differences in the style of drawing, and there were always World War II references and so on. But But somehow or other, I didn't quite distinguish among it all. And I think that was an important thing because my father grew up reading essentially the very same comic books that I had read. And they were reprinting the things that were new when he was a kid. And it formed this sort of continuum of, I don't know what you want to call it, almost a kind of a imaginative continuum that we had almost identical fantasy lives in some respect. And that got me interested in the world of his childhood, my father's childhood. He grew up in Brooklyn in the 1940s, and I used to ask him about things like the radio programs he listened to, the movie serials of the time, going to the theater on a Saturday morning for a full day of programming with the newsreel and the cartoons and the A picture and the B picture. And he was only too happy to kind of indulge this curiosity of mine. So he really vividly sort of recreated the world of his childhood in my imagination. And that's the world that I was trying to recreate, I guess, for myself and, you know, also for readers.
Now, you also mentioned at the end of the book, I think it's in your acknowledgments, that your grandfather worked as a typographer in a plant that published, among other things, comic books. Did that give you any special access to or interest in comics?
I guess, well, it partly always gave me an awareness of the technical, or maybe the better word would be the sort of technological side of comic books, that there were printing plants and there were these guys whose job it was to take the big photo engraving plates and, you know, run them on the presses and all of that stuff. I was aware of that from a fairly early age. But I think more importantly was just that it was my father's father who had gotten him into comic books by bringing home bags filled with comic books from his job. He worked the night shift and he would bring home these big bags of comics for my father to read. And that's how it all began. And I think in a way this book is just sort of the outcome of that initial act of kind of fatherly generosity that my grandfather performed for my dad.
What are some of the things that you see in superhero comics now as an adult that you didn't see in them as a kid?
The ones you mean in the ones that I read or the ones that are being published now?
No, the ones that you read when you were a kid.
It's funny. I've just been rereading with my own children these comics, the Legion of Superheroes, which was this DC Comics title. I think it continues to this day. In fact, I'm sure it does. It started in the late 50s and ran all through the 60s, and they've been made available in these nice hardbound reprint editions. And I love them as a kid. It's this futuristic band of teenage superheroes with the most absurd powers you could possibly imagine. I was almost at a loss in writing The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay when I needed to come up with a ridiculous power for a superhero. I often found that, you know, a lot of even the ridiculous powers have long since been taken, and you find a lot of the ridiculous powers in the Legion of Superheroes. So you have heroes like Matter Eater Lad from the planet Bismol, who has the power of eating anything. And there's another superhero who's kind of pudgy, and he's called Bouncing Boy, and he can... That's his power, is he can bounce. And my kids are completely enthralled by this stuff. They're young. They're 6 and 3. And they seem to be taking it all in on this very serious surface level. But I find that there's this almost, it's a kind of unhinged, I would almost say that these comics resemble a little bit the fantasies of like paranoid schizophrenics in some ways. Everything has variations of meaning, and for every superhero there seems to exist a superhero with an equal and opposite power, and then there are these vast conspiracies of rival gangs of superheroes. There are these, it's such an elaborated world, and I think the thing that I appreciate the most now looking over this stuff is, on one hand, the sheer lunacy of it all, and on the other hand, the incredibly vibrant imagination, as a kind of collective imagination that went into creating those books.
Now, the superhero, the Escapist, in your novel, in the Escapist comics, he uses his powers to try and fight Hitler. And, you know, both of the creators of the Escapist are Jewish, and one of them is a refugee from Czechoslovakia, and his parents are left behind, and he can't get them out. So, you know, he has many reasons to want to fight Hitler personally. But yes. But he's doing it through his creation, The Escapist. How much of the superhero comics during the period of World War II had World War II backdrops?
Well, World War II made the comic book, and especially the superhero. They almost exactly coincided. Superman first appeared in 1938, and in the first few appearances, or let's say the first couple of years of his existence, he had kind of a late 30s sort of socially messianic aspect to him, in that he was always, rounding up corrupt mine owners and foiling corrupt union bosses and so on. And then there appeared this figure of Adolf Hitler and the Nazis and also, it should be said, that the Japanese too after Pearl Harbor. And that was perfect. That was exactly what the superhero was designed to fight. And yes, the superheroes went to war en masse. Oddly enough, with the exception of Superman, who pretty much stayed home during the Second World War, I think his creators must have realized that even though you had Captain America and the Human Torch and so on over there fighting the Luftwaffe and the Wehrmacht and so on, that if Superman really did get into World War II, he'd probably be able to wrap it up fairly quickly and to sort of get around that fundamental problem. Superman pretty much stayed home and fought saboteurs and so on. But all the other superheroes went to war, and comic book sales just skyrocketed during the war years into the several millions of copies per month sold of each individual issue. They were also shipped in crates over to the GIs fighting in Europe, along with cigarettes and gum and so on. And a lot of GIs discovered comic books while fighting in Europe and then came home with their taste for comic books whetted. And so the boom of comic books continued even after the war was over. But it was never really the same for superheroes. And, you know, when they came back from the war and were forced once again to deal with, you know, card sharps and gamblers and so on, it was not the superhero genre died out actually fairly quickly after the war.
Michael Chabon is the author of Wonder Boys and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which just won a Pulitzer Prize. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Superman. Yes, it's Superman, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal men. Superman.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Do fiction writers suffer from some kind of disorder? Michael Chabon says yes. He's even given it a name. Coming up, we continue our interview with the Pulitzer Prize-winning author. And rock historian Ed Ward remembers the music of the group Love.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Michael Chabon. His novel Wonder Boys was adapted into last year's film starring Michael Douglas as professor and novelist Grady Tripp. Chabon won a Pulitzer Prize 2 weeks ago for his latest novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, an homage to the early days of superhero comics. Both of the main characters in your novel, who were comic book artists, are Jewish, and the creators of Superman were Jewish as well. In your novel, one character says that all superheroes are Jewish. He says, "Superman, you don't think he's Jewish? Coming from the old country, changing his name like that? Clark Kent. Only a Jew would pick a name like that for himself." What do you mean? Because it's so non-Jewish sounding? This is somebody trying to pass?
It's just so, exactly. It's just so, goyish sounding. Yeah. And they all had names like that. The Flash, the Golden Age Flash, his name was Jay Garrick and Bruce Wayne. And, you know, they all had these names that were just taken right off of you know, I don't know, they sound like housing streets and housing developments in the suburbs. I it seemed to me that this was a case, and then I was actually a little bit dismayed, although also excited to see my intuition confirmed when Jules Pfeiffer, the great Jules Pfeiffer, wrote an obituary for Jerry Siegel in the New York Times and made this exact same point about the kind of disguised assimilationist fantasy that Superman represents, and that with this idea of coming from Krypton and, you know, leaving his real parents behind, and even his name, Kal-El, that's the real name of Superman. It has that kind of vaguely Hebraic sound.
That's true.
I'm sure this is another example of something that was just at work in the minds or in the consciousnesses of Siegel and Schuster.
In your book, there's a subcommittee investigating whether comics lead youth into juvenile delinquency. And I know there really was a subcommittee investigating comics. But in your book, one of the aspects that that they're interested in investigating is the Batman-Robin relationship, superheroes with boy sidekicks.
Yeah.
And they ask,
yeah,
was this a thinly veiled allegory of pedophilic inversion? And one of the investigators says, in outfitting these muscular, strapping young fellows in tight trousers and sending them flitting around the skies together, were you in any way expressing or attempting to disseminate your own psychological proclivities? And he asks this to one of the comic book artists who actually is a closeted gay man. Did the comic book investigating committee really investigate veiled homosexuality in the comics?
Well, they alluded to it. They stayed away from that. The hearings were fascinating. They were actually televised, and I've met people that grew up in the area then and remember watching them on television. And they were mostly concerned with the violence that was prevalent, especially in the EC horror comics of the time, and the kind of gruesome scenes that went often found in them, and with depictions of drug addiction and antisocial behavior of other kinds. As I recall, and I read through the transcripts, there was some allusion to the latent homosexual fantasies that comic books were alleged to contain and disseminate, but they did stay away from it for the most part. However, Dr. Frederick Wortham, whose book The Seduction of the Innocent was really the trigger for these hearings, devoted an entire chapter, as I recall, of this book to this very subject, and he explored the highly questionable relationship between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson. And also, he was not too happy with the sexuality of Wonder Woman either, and viewed her as being clearly having lesbian tendencies, and that this was all warping the minds of America's youth. So I fictionalized that aspect of the hearing, but it didn't seem to me to be completely out of character with the hearing itself or with the kinds of things that they were worrying about.
So to sum up, you have congressmen investigating the ambiguously gay duo.
Exactly. And they, you know, I think that aspect of comic books, that the critique that Dr. Wortham offered was a kind of stinging one to guys that were doing comic books at the time. I really don't think they had any intention of telling any kind of stories other than stories about sort of father figures adopting these sort of war. They always had these wards, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I remember as a kid, I didn't know any wards. I didn't know anybody could be a ward, but comic books were filled with wards.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael Chabon, and his latest book, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, about two creators of superhero comics, just won a Pulitzer Prize. His previous book, Wonder Boys, was made into a film starring Michael Douglas. In your previous novel, Wonder Boys, the main character, who's a writer, says that the first real writer he knew was someone who started off writing horror stories, and many of the stories were published in periodicals of the day, like Weird Tales, Strange Stories, Black Tower. Did you know someone like that yourself?
No, I didn't. I
bet you wish you did.
Yes, I do. I mean, I feel like that character's name is August Van Zorn, or that's his pen name. His real name was Albert Vetch, and I think it's more the case that I sort of have an inner August Van Zorn. I've always been drawn to that kind of Lovecraftian horror fiction. I have a real weakness for it. And I just imagined this guy into my life. It was almost as if I had had him as a mentor myself. But no, it's completely fictitious. I have since then written a couple of stories sort of in the voice of August Van Zorn. One of them was recently published in the New Yorker, but they wouldn't let me publish it as an August Van Zorn story. They forced me to put my own name on it.
Would you have preferred publishing it as August Van Zorn?
Or at least tipping my hat to him in some way, because I do feel that when I wrote both of those stories, that I was very much in some way channeling August Van Zorn and not writing in my own voice at all.
So who was the first real writer that you knew?
That's a really interesting question. I know I grew up with a family friend, a woman named Ruth Glick, who has become a kind of one of the queens of romance fiction. Although at the time, I think she was just starting out. She had not at all made the career for herself that she has since. And she may well be the first writer that I ever knew. And what I remember most about her is that even at the age of 6 or 7, she took me very seriously when I said that I wanted to be a writer, and she started handing me things to read that she herself had loved. So that was probably an important sort of first writer to have met.
Were they romance novels that she gave you?
No, science fiction. And the one I remember most is A.E. Van Vogt's Slan, which was a really terrifying and almost a scarring experience for me to read, but I just completely loved it.
When you were a young writer, did you go through a very pretentious period of imitating the great writers who you read and wanted to be like?
Definitely. In fact, some people probably would say I still haven't come out of that pretentious period, but I was a slavish imitator of my favorite writers for many years, starting with Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. When I was about 10 years old, I wrote a kind of pastiche Sherlock Holmes story, inspired in part, I guess, by Nicholas Meyer's 7% Solution, which came out around that time. And I wrote my own imitation of Doyle, and thereafter just began imitating one writer after another, Ray Bradbury, and then Henry Miller, then John Updike, Donald Barthelme, Raymond Chandler. I think I learned how to write.
Wait, did you do a lot of sex stuff during your Henry Miller era?
Yeah, and it was even more an act of imagination than coming up with August Van Zorn. Yes, definitely. Henry Miller has this really intoxicating, unhinged, exclamatory style of writing that was very distinctive, very easy to catch onto, and also somehow made it seem okay to write about the kinds of things that he was writing about, and that then I therefore invented for my own characters, since I had no actual personal experience of them.
Did you go through a period of not only imitating great writers who you admired on the page, but imitating them in life as well?
I tried. You know, Henry Miller, I think that just reading Henry Miller had a very heavy influence on my decision to become a writer, because I really did think it was going to be all about lying around in tawdry cliche apartments, drinking cheap red wine,
and
very
sex.
Quickly, exactly, lots of it too, preferably with multiple partners of dubious sexuality and even gender. But it didn't work out that way. His was really, of all my early heroes, I think his was probably the only. He was the only really writer that had that kind of lifestyle attached to his writing. You know, the other ones, Bradbury, somebody like John Updike, or I was really into Thomas Mann for a while. I mean, writers like that, they didn't have that kind of the glamorous lifestyle. They were more about going into your office and shutting the door behind you and staying in there until you got some writing done. And that has actually turned out to be much more the case with my life, too.
Pretty exciting.
Oh, yeah.
My guest is Michael Chabon. He won a Pulitzer Prize a couple of weeks ago for his latest novel, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Chabon, author of Wonder Boys and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which just won a Pulitzer Prize. Now, in Wonder Boys, your main character wonders if fiction writers suffered from a rare disorder from what he calls the midnight disease. What is the midnight disease?
Well, the midnight disease is essentially, I think, it's two things. It's the way in which writers, and this is sort of my theory too, although I think it means a lot more to Grady Tripp than it does to me, but I think that when you're a writer, you're forced into this observer position all the time, that you're always sort of paying attention to things on a level that necessarily means that you aren't participating in them, and therefore that you often have a sense of detachment from things that are going on around you, or that you're not fully participating in sort of the rich pageant of life because you're busy trying to get it all down or remember it so you can use it later on. So that's part of the midnight disease, and the other aspect of it that is definitely more important to Grady Tripp than it is to me is that. Not only do you sort of get forced out of the participating in life by trying to pay attention to it, but you also begin to engineer your own life so that it will provide you with richer material for your fiction. And I think that's more of a problem for Grady than it is for me, but I have observed it myself, I think, in other writers, certainly, that I've known, that there seems to be this almost... imperative to create drama in one's life as a way of sort of what Grady calls as a hedge against any lack of future material.
I want to actually read your description in Wonder Boys of the Midnight Disease. You describe it as a kind of emotional insomnia. At every conscious moment, its victim, even if he or she writes at dawn or in the middle of the afternoon, feels like a person lying in a sweltering bedroom with the window thrown open, looking up at a sky filled with stars and airplanes, listening to the narrative of a rattling blind, an ambulance, a fly trapped in a Coke bottle, while all around him the neighbors soundly sleep. This is, in my opinion, why writers, like insomniacs, are so accident-prone, so obsessed with a calculus of bad luck and missed opportunities, so liable to rumination and a concomitant inability to let go of a subject, even when urged repeatedly to do so. I'm interested in that obsessiveness, that inability to let go of a subject. Do you think that's something unique? Do you think that's something a lot of writers have?
Yeah, I don't think it's unique to writers by any means.
But writers have their own big dose of it.
It seems to me, and I know I'm that way, and it just I've had the experience so many times of just finding myself at the other end of a kind of obsessive. Going over again and again of a particular experience that I might have undergone with another writer, say we've gone off to do something or other, even if it's as simple as, you know, trying to pick up something at Target or something like that, that the experience will get just sort of broken down. Like, why do you think the clerk was looking at me that way? Do you think that she noticed that I had tape on my glasses? And it's that kind of obsessive going over things that maybe is just a byproduct of always going over plots of stories and trying to, you know, get everything sort of causally oriented, which is always what you try to do with a plot, is, you know, have this sort of causal imperative to things. And life often tends not to have such a strong kind of cause and effect thing, but I think it's something that you get in the habit of seeing, even if it's not there, definitely.
Because there are central characters in several of your novels who are gay, a lot of readers have assumed that you were gay. And I think one major news weekly wrote that you were gay,
yes,
which is not true. You're married and have two children. But anyways, I'm
wondering... that has been pointed out that, of course, that is no guarantee of anything. But
yes, true. You could just be very, very closeted. But,
that's right.
But I'll make the assumption that you're probably not just very closeted.
Okay.
But I shouldn't assume anything.
The question is,
do you have any very amusing stories that come out of this assumption?
Well, I don't know if they're amusing. I had a couple of what would I call them? Slightly, almost upsetting experiences fairly early on when the whole Chabon is gay thing was much more current than it is now. You know, back it was sort of like the Paul is dead thing, I guess. And you know, I would get booked into a bookstore, a place like Lambda Rising or Different Light, and would read something from, say, my first short story collection that was not any, had no real overt gay content of any kind, because I didn't really think it mattered what I read. But there were people to whom it did matter a lot, and there were some people that, you know, I think were upset that I was being somehow billed as other than I really was, or that I think there were some people in the gay literary community that felt that somehow I was being put over as a gay writer when I really wasn't, and that wasn't fair. So, but nothing really amusing, unfortunately. That would have been nice.
Well, how did you handle coming out as heterosexual? you know, because it wouldn't be, if people are assuming that you're gay, on the one hand, you don't want to kind of falsely get the loyalty of a gay audience by appearing to be gay if you're not. On the other hand, you don't want to kind of trot around a woman on your arm all the time just to kind of prove you're not.
Right,
exactly. That would make it seem like you were so uncomfortable with the possibility of somebody perceiving you as gay.
Right, you're right. It's been a kind of a balancing act for me. I mean, I've always thought of that character in that movie, The Turning Point. You know, I think it's Tom Skerritt's character who at some point is accused by his wife that he only married her to prove to everybody that he wasn't really gay. And there's that aspect of it. And on the other hand, as you say, there's, you know, not wanting to seem to be falsely representing myself. Maybe I'm fortunate in having kind of come of age in the time that I did, say, in the early 1980s, when the categories started to get blurred a little bit more. I've always had as one of my great heroes, Prince, and I have always taken as great comfort in his sort of the way that he almost refused to identify himself in any way, because that would be satisfying other people's expectations too much. I don't have anything like his courage or his chutzpah, God knows, but it was just somehow not ultimately that important to me. And really what I always felt I was most interested in writing about, especially in The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, my first novel, was a world in which those categories don't really apply, and that you have a character in that novel who's not sure what he is. To quote a Prince song, you know, "Am I straight or gay?" is the question that he's faced with in that novel. And what he ends up deciding is that those are just labels, and they don't really apply to his own emotional experience. I think there's a paucity of labels for people's sexuality, but fiction is a way of kind of filling up the gaps in our vocabulary that allows us so few true options for expressing our feelings about people of the same sex.
Well, Michael, I guess it's been about 2 weeks since you won the Pulitzer.
Yes, it has, about 2 weeks, yeah.
So has your life changed dramatically in those 2 weeks?
Not so much. Nothing I'm aware of yet. I guess I've gotten a few more invitations to participate in various kinds of conferences and so on than I used to get. My email box filled up, but other than that, once the initial excitement kind of died down, things have more or less returned to normal. At least I hope so.
Well, I want to congratulate you.
Thank you.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Such a treat. Thank you, Terry.
Michael Chabon is the author of Wonder Boys and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which won this year's Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward on the group Love. This is Fresh Air. In mid-60s Los Angeles, love was in the air. Not just the emotion, but the band, headed by the talented Arthur Lee. The band imploded after their third album, Forever Changes, which was recently reissued by Rhino Records. Rock historian Ed Ward has the story.
It was 1967, and Arthur Lee, the leader of Los Angeles' top band, Love, had decided he was dying. There was no real reason for him to believe this, and he's still with us today. But as he sat writing songs for the new album he owed Elektra Records, his thoughts were mighty dark.
Sitting on the hillside, watching all the people die. I'll feel much better on the other side of the I believe in magic. Why? Because it is so quick. I don't need power when I'm hypnotized. Look in my eyes.
Since 1965, Love had been the top band on the Sunset Strip, inheriting the mantle from the Byrds, who had become international stars and too big to play the clubs. Elektra Records, a folk label, had signed them for some reason and had had a good-sized hit with Little Red Book, which the band had gotten from Burt Bacharach. Their first album had done well, and a second album, Da Capo, came next. By this time, the band was in shaky condition, and the label recorded a long freakout to cover the second side of the record because they didn't want to wait for songs they figured the band would never deliver. But in the spring of 1967, to everyone's surprise, Arthur announced he was ready to record. Elektra looked around for a producer and found Bruce Botnick, who told them that he and his friend Neil Young from the Buffalo Springfield would do it.
In the morning we arise and start the day the same old way as yesterday, the day before, and for it all it's just a daylight. All the rest, so do your best with chewing gum and it is oh so repetitious.
It took Arthur a while to assemble the band, but in June they entered the studio. By this time, Neil Young had to start work on the Springfield's new record, but it's thought that the Daily Planet, which we just heard, has elements of his arranging on it. Arrangements were important to the sound of this new record. This was an ambitious project and not easily reproduced live. Fortunately, besides being a brilliant engineer, Bruce Botnick was a good arranger and was working with Herb Alpert some at the time. It shows.
What is happening and how have you been? Gotta go, but I'll see you again. And oh, the music is so loud. And then I fade into the... Crowds of people standing everywhere. The street, I'm at the slop affair, and here they always play my songs,
and me. I wonder if it's
because the arrangements were so complicated and the band, let's face it, so stoned much of the time, Lee and Botnick used studio players on a couple of tracks. But they soon realized that the music was so strange, so unlike anything any of the pros had played, that it would be easier to teach the parts to the band. And it was strange. Love had never been an easy band to classify, but Arthur's Dread had produced melodies and lyrics that were odder than ever before.
Oh, the snot has caked against my pants. It has turned into crystal. There's a bluebird sitting on a branch. I guess I'll take my pistol. I've got it in my hand. Because he's on my land. And so the story ended. You know it all so well. Oh shit, you need I'll tell you.
One thing I haven't mentioned is that Arthur and the lead guitarist Johnny Eccles were black. Arthur knew Jimi Hendrix from his scuffling days and knew he couldn't compete with him, but he was determined to make it as a black man in a white scene in his own way. He'd also mentioned Love's top rivals, The Doors, to Elektra, and they'd signed them and recorded them, although the album didn't go into general release until the summer of 1967, when Love was already in the studio. The pressure was immense, and it would prove fatal to the band. It was also probably the source of Arthur's feeling of doom. In September, they wrapped up the recording, and in November, Love Forever Changes came out. As always, the band refused to tour outside California, and after recording another single, they fell apart. But few groups have ever exited with such a brilliant and enigmatic swan song.
Rock historian Ed Ward lives in Berlin. Love's album Forever Changes was recently reissued. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today was Roberta Schirach. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Anne-Marie Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Tulip Fever by Deborah Maugas, a novel about the tulipomania set in 17th century Amsterdam. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the story of Colombian cocaine cartel kingpin Pablo Escobar and the United States' role in tracking and killing him. We talked to journalist Mark Bowden about his book, Killing Pablo. Bowden's previous book was the bestseller Black Hawk Down about the U.S. mission in Somalia. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.